Well, I'm thrilled to open God's Word with you this morning. If you got a Bible, open it to the book of Genesis, chapter 29 is where we're going to be today. I was outside my house a couple days ago when the UPS truck drove up. You ever had this experience where you have to interact with the UPS driver? Usually they just leave it on the doorstep and you're good, right? So he says to me, "Hey, I've got these two packages for you, but my computer says there's a third package, but I don't see it on the truck. Can you describe what it might be to me?" And I was thinking, I have no idea. I think that's pretty bad, right? We got into a bad place where you have no idea what you've ordered from Amazon. Like, it's just things are just showing up at your house. And you're, oh, yeah, I forgot that, yeah. And so he said, well, the computer says there's a third. Probably what happened is there was a mix-up at the distribution facility. You know, they go through lots of hands. There's lots of different trucks going all over the place. Probably there's a little mix-up. I'm sure it will get here either later today or tomorrow, and you know, somebody just made a mistake along the way, it'll be fine. And I go, okay, very cool. That sounds good. That works out. This is the story of Genesis chapter 29 and into chapter 30. What do I mean? I mean this. This Genesis is the story of our beginnings, right? And what we've seen so far is God making a big promise to restore humanity to blessing through a family, Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob. So the same promise God made to Abraham and Isaac, he's now made to Jacob, that he'll become a great nation, that he will have a name that extends farther than he could ever imagine, that is have children more than or the sand on the shore, the stars in the sky, that all the world, every nation would be blessed through this family, and God would use them to bring about redemption and restoration. And he's planning through this family to fulfill the promise he made even before Abraham that he made to the serpent in the garden, where he promised the serpent that Eve would have an offspring that would crush the serpent who brought temptation to the humans and caused them to choose sin. Like my packages from Amazon on the UPS truck, God's promises have had to go through the hands of sinful people that are making lots of mistakes. But the story ultimately shows how God delivers on his promises despite the sinful failures and mistakes of his people. So Genesis 29 and 30 tells the story of a lot of sinful failure, a lot of mistakes. But it also gives us a way to track God's faithfulness through it all. So let's read this passage. It's about a chapter and a half. And I'm going to make some interjections throughout just to help you kind of piece all the things, the little details together. And then I'm going to make 2 points about what this teaches us about God. Cool? Genesis chapter 29, verse 1. If you don't have a scripture with you or on your phone, you can follow along on the screen. It says, Jacob resumed his journey and went to the eastern country. He looked and saw a well in a field. 3 flocks of sheep were lying there beside it because the sheep were watered from this well. But a large stone covered the opening of the well. The shepherds would roll the stone from the opening of the well and water the sheep when all the flocks were gathered there. Then they would return the stone to its place over the well's opening. Jacob asked the men at the well, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they said. "Do you know Laban, grandson of Nahor?" Jacob asked them. They answered, "We know him." "Is he well?" Jacob asked. "Yeah," they said. "And here's his daughter Rachel coming with his sheep." Then Jacob said, "Look, it's still broad daylight. It's not time for the animals to be gathered. Water the flock, then go out. Let them graze." He's kind of saying, "Get out of here." But they replied, "We can't wait. We can't until all the flocks have been gathered and the stone is rolled from the well's opening. Then we will water the sheep." And while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And as soon as Jacob saw his uncle Laban's daughter Rachel with his sheep, he went up, rolled the stone from the opening, and watered his uncle Laban's sheep. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept loudly. He told Rachel that he was her father's relative, Rebekah's son. She ran and told her father. Let me just pause there. bring out a couple things in this text. First is you recognize that Jacob's going east. Well, up until this point in the book of Genesis, when anybody goes east, you know danger's ahead, right? All the way back to Cain. After the murder of Abel, where did he go? He went east and built cities. How about the Tower of Babel? That was because the descendants of Noah had gone east, right? East is always the direction of sin. I'm not saying anything bad about Wascom, Shreveport, you guys. I'm just saying, Jacob's heading east. We know trouble's ahead, okay? Well, what does he find when he gets to Haran, which is where Abraham came from, if you remember Genesis chapter 11 and 12? What does he find? He finds these shepherds, and he says, do you guys know Laban, the grandson of Nahor? They said, yeah, we know him. And Jacob says, is he well? Now, this is an interesting little phrase. First, I stopped on it because of the English translation says here in this one, is he well? And I thought that's kind of a funny pun, at standing at the well, is he well? But then I found out what it actually says is there peace with him? Is there peace with him? And the word shalom from our Hebrew word, which eventually became part of the name of the city Jerusalem, the city of peace, shows up right here. Is there peace with Laban? And they said, yeah. Which means, if you read the rest of the story, either they didn't really know Laban, or they were just blinded because there was not going to be much peace between Jacob and Laban. And then we see Jacob meeting Rachel for the first time. Emotions are running high. He's thinking, I've been single for so long, and here I am. I've followed all the instructions of my parents. I've had this dream where God met me, and he sent me on my way, and I'm surely God is providing for me in the same way that he provided for my father, a wife from the family of my grandfather, Abraham. This is all good, and look, oh man, she's beautiful, and he runs, and he embraces her, and he kisses her, and then he starts crying. There's some cultural things here that like we don't quite comprehend, right? But girls, this is a good lesson. If a man comes up to you and kisses you and starts crying and then tells you he's your cousin, then just you should go run and tell your father also, okay? This is just, but for different reasons than Rachel. Rachel runs and tells Laban. Let's see how Laban responds. Verse 13, when Laban heard the news about his sister's son Jacob, he ran to meet him, hugged him, and kissed him. Then he took him to his house. Jacob told him all that had happened. Laban said to him, yes, you are my own flesh and blood. After Jacob had stayed with him a month, Laban said to him, just because you're my relative, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be. So what's happening here? First of all, we see as Laban returns the favor of the kiss and takes Jacob home, Jacob retells the story. This is all sounding very familiar. If you remember a few chapters ago when Abraham sent his servant on behalf of his son Isaac to the very same place and met the very same family, Jacob's mother, Rebekah, was sister and brother with Laban, right? So this is all sounding very familiar probably to Laban. Abraham's servant, though, as opposed to Jacob, came a little bit differently. And I would bet Laban is remembering this because Abraham's servant showed up with, if you remember, bukus of stuff, camels, herds, money, and says, I'm looking for a wife for my master. And we read all about that story a couple chapters ago. Jacob, however, shows up empty-handed. But Laban remembers. So he invites him in, kisses him. He's got dollar signs floating in his eyes, right? This is what Laban is beginning to think. But things start to change. He says, you are my own flesh and blood. The literal translation is as you are my bone and flesh. But the idiomatic translation is my flesh and blood. He's saying like, we're related, but there's even more to that. It's actually Laban is saying to Jacob, you and I, we're cut from the same cloth, which comes around to be more true than either of them recognize. So Laban starts now to change his tune because he sees Jacob. He's been around him for a month. And unlike Abraham's servant, Jacob's empty-handed. He doesn't offer much to Laban. And so the rules start to change. In verse 16, the tension of the story is introduced. Now Laban had two daughters. The older was named Leah. The younger was named Rachel. Leah had tender eyes, but Rachel was shapely and beautiful. Jacob loved Rachel, so he answered Laban, "I'll work for you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." And Laban replied, "Better that I give her to you than some other man. Stay with me." So Jacob worked 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. That's interesting because remember what Rebekah told Jacob when she was sending him out, that hopefully he would only be gone for a few days and then the Lord would bring him back. Well, he was gone for a couple decades, right? But seven of those years only seemed like a few days to him because of his love for Rachel. I want you to keep that in mind because we're going to see that come up again in a few verses. But we've got this tension of now Jacob's coming to find a wife. He's met Rachel. He goes to the house of Laban. And then all of a sudden the narrator tells us Laban has two daughters. We got to go, okay, something is going up, is going to happen with this. This is going to come into play. And the two daughters are juxtaposed in verse 17. Leah, who has tender eyes, which you may have heard, but is not a real complimentary thing to say in the Hebrew. It means that she has maybe a lazy eye, or maybe she's cross-eyed. But even before they got to that point where they're saying that Leah is kind of hard to look at, they said her name, Leah, which could also be translated wild cow. This is not like a good start for Leah, right? I mean, she's got an uphill battle, no matter who she meets, okay? Contrast that with Rachel, whose name means like a ewe or a lamb, like a something that's like soft and careful and something's gentle and snuggly, maybe even. So this is Rachel, and she has a beautiful form, and she's shapely. Essentially, what's happening here is we're showing this reality that Rachel exceeded expectations. And that's even another way to translate this beautiful in form and shape, that Rachel exceeds. So Leah, it's kind of hard to look at. Rachel, you go, "Oh, wow, she's more beautiful than I could have imagined." This is the contrast of the two sisters, okay? So Jacob loved Rachel, obviously. Let's read from verse 21 on. It says, "Jacob said to Laban, 'Since my time is complete, the 7 years of work, give me my wife so I can sleep with her.' So Laban invited all the men of the place and sponsored a feast. That evening, Laban took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob, and he slept with her." Whoa. "And Laban gave his slave Zilpah to his daughter Leah as her slave. When morning came, there was Leah. So he," Jacob, "said to Laban, 'What is this you have done to me? Wasn't it for Rachel that I worked for you? Why have you deceived me?' Laban answered, 'It's not the custom in this place to give the younger daughter in marriage before the firstborn. Complete this week of wedding celebration, and we will also give you this younger one in return for working yet another 7 years for me.' And Jacob did just that. He finished the week of celebration, and Laban gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. And Laban gave his slave Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her slave. Jacob slept with Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah. And he worked for Laban another 7 years." Okay, so within the span of 9 verses, Jacob goes from an excited bachelor in love at first sight to a deceived and disgruntled husband of two wives who is still indebted to his conniving boss, who, by the way, happens to be his now father-in-law. Things are not going well for him. As one person said, a wishbone has two sides, but when a wishbone is broken, one side always ends up longer and the other always ends up shorter. This is why God designed marriage, by the way, for one man and one woman, Because up until this point, we've been hearing the story from Jacob's perspective. Now we're starting to see from God's perspective that things are going awry. And he loves one and he essentially hates the other. Leah's always going to end up with the short side of the wishbone, right? We're not meant to be in the relationships like this. So let's hear from God's perspective. What is God seeing? Verse 31. When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb. But Rachel was unable to conceive. Leah conceived, gave birth to a son, and named him Reuben. For she said, "The Lord has seen my affliction. Surely my husband will love me now." We want to pay attention to these names, by the way, that are showing up in this story. The name Reuben sounds like the word in Hebrew for that which means, "The Lord has seen my affliction." So his name tells a story. Not just in this verse, but for his entire life. He'll be a reminder to Leah that God sees her and hoping that one day her husband will also see her. Verse 33, she conceived again, gave birth to a son and said, "The Lord heard that I'm unloved and has given me this son also." So she named him Simeon, which sounds like the word for "he heard." So again, Simeon, for his entire life, every time his name is called, is going to tell the story about how God heard her cry and hoping one day that Jacob also would hear her. Verse 34, she conceived again, gave birth to a son and said, "At last, my husband will become attached to me because I have borne three sons for him." Therefore, he was named Levi, which sounds like the Hebrew word for attached to. Verse 35, she conceived again, gave birth to a son, and said, "This time I will praise the Lord." Therefore, she named him Judah, which sounds like the word in Hebrew for praise. Then Leah stopped having children. Moms in the room are like, man, four in a row like that, right? That's wild. She stopped having children. Leah desperately wanted to be loved by Jacob. And you can see that in even how she names her own children. Jacob is not only not really caring about Leah, he's not even really involved in this whole picture at all, from conception to even naming of these kids. He's just sort of a silent partner here. But what we find from God's perspective is how he sees and hears and pays attention to Leah and responds when she praises him. She desperately wants Jacob to love her, but she's always disappointed. So after four kids, she finally realizes there's only one whose love is sure and consistent, the love of God. So on the fourth, she praises him for the blessing of children. But in true human form, Jacob's wives continue taking matters into their own hands. Wives, making the same familiar mistakes we've already seen in Genesis, by the way, of giving slaves and surrogate wives. Jacob himself falls into the same sinful mold of the passive husband, just like his grandfather Abraham, who fails to love and lead his family, and it seems to spiral out of control until God intervenes. So let's read what happens here. That's kind of the preview of what's coming. Chapter 30, when Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children, she envied her sister. "Give me sons or I will die," she said to Jacob. Jacob became angry with Rachel and said, "Am I in God's place who has withheld offspring from you?" Finally, Jacob seems to get something right. What he's really saying to Rachel here is, "Am I God?" For Jacob's entire life up to this point, he's been trying to take what God would promise to give. Rachel does the same thing, and finally Jacob gets the right perspective and says, "Rachel, this isn't something we can just make happen. God is above all. God opens and closes wombs." This has been part of the theme of Genesis up until this point. And so finally we see Jacob get something right. Then Rachel says, "Here's my maid, Bilhah. Go sleep with her and she'll bear children for me so that through her I too can build a family." So Rachel gave her slave Bilhah to Jacob as a wife, and he slept with her. So Jacob's run of good things there ended pretty quickly. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Rachel said, God has vindicated me. Yes, he has heard me and given me a son. So she named him Dan, which, by the way, sounds like the Hebrew word for vindicated or judged. So again, Dan, a lifetime of reminding Rachel exactly what she'd been through. Verse 7, Rachel's slave Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Rachel said, in my wrestlings with God, I have wrestled with my sister and won. And she named him Naphtali, which sounds like the Hebrew word wrestling. Rachel wasn't quite correct, though. I mean, so far, Rachel had zero children of her own. Leah had four. Her slave had two. What happens next? Verse 9, when Leah saw that she had stopped having children, she took her slave Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Leah's slave Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, what good fortune! And she named him Gad, which, by the way, sounds like the Hebrew word for good fortune. So again, names are telling a story here. When Leah's slave Zilpah bore Jacob a second son, Leah said, I'm happy that the women call me happy. So she named him Asher, which is the Hebrew word for happy. Reuben went out during the wheat harvest and found some mandrakes in the field. And when he brought them to his mother Leah, Rachel asked, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But Leah replied to her, isn't it enough that you've taken my husband? Now you also want to take my son's mandrakes. Well then, Rachel said, he can sleep with you tonight in exchange for your son's mandrakes. Now, let me just pause here and go, okay, what's happening? What are mandrakes? How did that come into play? What's going on in this interchange? Okay, Leah, her son Reuben, has now found some, just you might call special flowers. In the ancient world, they would say that these were like aphrodisiacs, that these are flowers that sort of encourage romantic love. In fact, the word mandrake is the Hebrew word dudaim, which sounds a lot like the word for romantic love in the Hebrew, which is dodim. Okay, so there's almost like a little pun wordplay going on here. And what Rachel is essentially trying to do is buy Jacob's romantic love from Leah so that she can hopefully have more children. Rachel, in every way she knows how, is trying to orchestrate this whole scenario. And guess what? Up until this point, she's got a goose egg, right? Like on the scoreboard, she's still at zero. So verse 16, when Jacob came in from the field that evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come with me. I've hired you with my son's mandrakes. So Jacob slept with her that night. God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. So now Leah, who had stopped having children, is again having children. Leah said, God has rewarded me for giving my slave to my husband, and she named him Issachar, which sounds like the Hebrew word for reward. Now, whether that's actually what was happening is not necessarily true, but that's what she thought. Verse 19, then Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. Son, God has given me a good gift, Leah said. This time my husband will honor me because I've borne six sons for him. And she named him Zebulun, the word for honor. Again, she's telling a story. God's honored me, the Lord's honored me. Hopefully my husband will honor me. I'm hopeful. Later, Leah bore a daughter and named her Dinah, the only name that we don't get a meaning for. Then God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son. And she said, God has taken away my disgrace. She named him Joseph, which she said, may the Lord add another son to me. And the name Joseph means he adds. So Rachel is telling a new story now with the name of her son, Joseph. How did Rachel get to this place where God remembers her? If you backtrack all the way to the beginning, she tries to manipulate and connive and buy her way into having children. Eventually, she just stops Leah continues to have children, a whole second round of children, and then Rachel doesn't come up again until verse 22, and it says God remembered her. And there's a sense in which Rachel just kind of gave up everything she brought to the table, and that's when God started to work. Now, this is an interesting story. It's a story of deception. It's a story of division. So what could this possibly teach us about God? Two things. Number one, it reveals God's hand, how God works through sinners. Remember how my story about the package coming from UPS, that it goes through the distribution facility and there's lots of opportunity for mistakes to happen as packages are gone from hand to hand onto truck and truck and truck, but that eventually it gets delivered to my house. And then the same way God uses, he works through sinners who are making mistakes constantly, ultimately to deliver on his promise to bring all humanity back into blessing. So we've seen tons of mistakes in this chapter and a half. And what we learn from the first, especially the first part, is we see God's hand, that he works through sinners. Just talk about it for a second. Jacob certainly had learned a lesson about what it feels like to be deceived. Go back to chapter 29, look at verse 25 and 26. Jacob, who now appears just as oblivious as his own father, whom he deceived only two chapters ago, asks Laban, his new father-in-law, "Why did you deceive me?" And Laban's response is telling. Did you catch it? He said, "Because it's not the custom to give the younger before the older." And this is going to be ringing a huge gong in Jacob's mind as he reflects back on his own life, which has been full of deceiving, and in order to take what was rightfully his older brother's, beginning with the birthright, right? "I'm going to make this stew. I'm going to sell you a stew for a birthright. I'm going to wait till your most vulnerable moment, and I'm going to try to take advantage of you. Then as blessing, I'm going to put on the clothing of an animal that we've killed and made another stew out of. We're going to serve the father Isaac a stew, and in his most vulnerable moment, and we're going to wait till Esau's away out in the field, and we're going to get Isaac to bless Jacob." He did this in conjunction with his mother, Rebekah, who, by the way, her brother is Laban, who, by the way, said, "Hey, Jacob, we're cut from the same cloth." Now we're starting to see the picture. This family is full of deception. And for the first time in Jacob's life, all of a sudden, he is getting a taste of his own medicine. And it's bitter. But the beauty in this story, is that in the midst of all this deception and division, there is a God who is working, even using the failures of humanity to deliver on his promise to bless the world through the family of Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob. God used Laban's evil deception. How? He used it to multiply Jacob's offspring. Did God condone what Laban did? No. Did God condone what Jacob did in working another 7 years to marry Rachel and have a polygamous marriage? No. We know from Genesis chapter 2 that's not God's plan. We know that anytime someone departs from God's plan from Genesis chapter 2, of marriage between one man and one wife, fully committed to one another in selfless love, that even you depart from that in any way, that it always leads to destruction, which is exactly what we see here in chapter 29 and 30. So no, God certainly does not condone of this polygamous relationship, yet he is also not thwarted by it. Because humans are sinful. From Genesis chapter 3. But even in the midst of human sin, God is working through human sin as his promise goes through the hands of sinners in order to deliver the offspring promised to Eve, the serpent that would crush the serpent. The offspring promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob that would bring redemption to the world. So let's see how it goes. Jacob has these 12 sons. If you continue reading the story, you see that these 12 sons grow up to be the 12 heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. Every tribe named after a son. Every son's name telling a story, by the way, of how people relate to God and one another. And as Genesis ends, 12 turns into 70. Jacob has 70 descendants at the end of Genesis. And then after that, it begins to grow even faster, multiplying astronomically. So that as the story develops in the next book, the book of Exodus, we see how God continues to work through human failure to accomplish his purpose, because God's people became so numerous that even the Pharaoh of Egypt was scared of them. So he enslaved them, and he ordered all the firstborn males to be killed, right? Yet God worked through that evil to bring a deliverer for his people named Moses into Pharaoh's household to eventually free his people from slavery and return them to the brink of the promised land. Ultimately, God worked through an unjust trial and an unwarranted execution on a Roman cross in the first century, where Jesus Christ was crucified, a moment of pure human evil levied against a purely holy God, yet used to bring about the greatest good for sinners: the forgiveness of sin and hope for life with God. So this is who God is and how God works. His hand is working through sinful humanity. You might have been misled by sinful humanity. You might have been mistreated by sinful humans. You yourself might have misplaced or mishandled the promises of God and sinned against others. Always ends in brokenness, doesn't it? Broken relationships, broken families, broken bodies, broken emotions, even broken churches. But God never wastes any of it in order to see his promises fulfilled, to make you and I whole again, to restore us to blessing, and to restore us to himself. This is how God works. So yeah, there may be consequences like Jacob endured, where he has a taste of his own medicine, right? Maybe consequences here on earth for our sin, possibly even discipline from God to shape and mold us into the person he wants us to become. But God is always faithful to redeem our messes and our mistakes. And so as we look at God's hand in this crazy story, it ought to well up hope within you that whatever mess you've encountered, whatever mess has happened to you, whatever mess you've made, when you submit to God in faith, he can redeem it. He can make it purposeful. He can work through it to accomplish good and blessing for all. It's good news here. It's like the story I heard recently of the guy who had tattoos on his arm, and when he was asked about it, it looked like, man, these tattoos kind of reflected like a pretty rough life, like maybe almost even embarrassing in a way to have them just out there on his forearm. But as soon as he was asked about them, his face lights up, and he rolls up his sleeve, and he says, yeah, this was my life before I met Jesus, but look what's happened now. God has redeemed my mess. God has saved me and called me into a life of obedience and faith. And that's the story God wants to write, not just on your flesh, but in your heart. Whatever mess you found yourself in that's happened to you or that you've created, God can work in it to redeem you and bring you back to blessing, call you to a life of faith and obedience. Jill's been reading a popular series of books. Every book is huge. They're huge, hundreds and hundreds of pages. But she says that the author spends most of the book just setting up the climax at the end. And this is the story of our lives. The days or the years seem long, full of suffering, sometimes stagnation, sometimes a search for significance. But we have to keep in mind that there is an author who was not surprised by the twists or the turns or the disappointments, but it's incorporating all of those things into a story of salvation and redemption for mankind and the restoration of all things. God's hand works through sinful people. That's the big picture. But then the story zooms in on the individuals, and we see that God has a heart that cares for the afflicted. That we aren't just pawns on God's chessboard. God isn't just up there in heaven moving pieces around, but he's also with us through it all. Did you see as chapter 29 ended and it began telling the story of Leah and how Jacob essentially hated Leah? He didn't just hate what happened to him, he actually hated her. But he loved Rachel. But it says God saw Leah and that she was unloved. And while she was so desperate for the love of Jacob, God was there all along loving her and blessing her. Leah longed to have Jacob's love, only had his children. Rachel, on the other hand, longed to have Jacob's children, only had his love. Bilhah and Zilpah, they're in the middle of the episode, right? They're right in the middle of the drama, but not in a good way. It's like Stevie Ray Vaughan sang about, they're caught in the crossfire, okay? This is these two slaves. This is not a good situation. They are afflicted. Like, these are people. The word slave, sometimes in our history, we look back and our first thought is that they're not individuals, that it's just something that happened to a group of people, but these are individuals that were experiencing extreme affliction. Right? They were less than. They were lowest. They could be given away like property. And so we got to recognize even Bilhah and Zilpah, they're right here in the middle. They're caught in the crossfire, but God still blesses them with children. He gives them meaning and purpose and dignity. He shows that they are dignified as image bearers of God, just like he said every person was. So slave, while it identifies who they were in relationship to that family, does not identify who they were in relationship to all creation. Identity is based on image of God, right? So God gives value and dignity to even these two. We saw how they engaged in polygamy, which is outside of God's plan, which is going to be an affliction against Leah and Rachel. Jacob couldn't choose one, so it's always a wishbone scenario. Someone's always going to get the short end of the bone, right? This is just going to happen. So Leah, how do we see God's heart caring for her? He loved her. He blessed her with children. God loved the unloved, which is who God is. And then we see this playing out in her life. The fourth son that she has is a son named Judah. If you flip your Bibles all the way to the New Testament, Matthew chapter 1, you know where Judah shows up? Judah's just a middle child, y'all. Like, who would really care about the middle child but God? God used Judah to be the ancestor of Jesus Christ in the lineage of Abraham. You've heard Jesus referred to as the Lion of Judah. It comes from right here. So God is with Leah in her suffering, working a bigger plan. How about Rachel? Rachel, who's kind of like the second Jacob, by the way. She's a younger sibling. She's deceiving and manipulating her older in order to take what the older sister has. This is about her life, right? No wonder it's love at first sight for Jacob, by the way, because when he saw Rachel, it's kind of like looking in a mirror. You know, everybody loves themselves, right? Rachel's just like Jacob, so of course. But Rachel's maneuvering revealed something that was broken inside of her. And it was only when she got to the end of herself and she recognized that she had no plan C, D, E, F, or G. She had no more strategies remaining. She could not do anything else to take matters into her own hands, and that everything she tried yielded zero result. It was only at that moment, in verse 22 of chapter 30, that we see God remembered Rachel. And that's a hugely important phrase because only two other times in Genesis has that phrase come up. One was Noah, as the floodwaters were about to recede. Chapter 8, Genesis verse 1 says, God remembered Noah. Genesis chapter 19, God remembered Abraham. He was about to give him a son of promise. So God remembers Rachel, which is to say that God had a covenant love. God had an unstoppable love that was based on grace alone toward Rachel. She did not deserve it. She did everything she could do to avoid it. But when she finally came to the end of herself and realized she offered nothing to the whole scenario, God blessed her. Leah enters the story empty-handed. Rachel enters the story heavy-handed. But the moment they both become open-handed is the moment where they trust God with their circumstances and they're finally able to receive and enjoy the blessing of God. Rachel's son Joseph goes on to save the nation of Israel from famine. So if you, like Leah, are looking to anything or anyone other than God to fill an emptiness in your life, you will never be filled. If you, like Rachel, have depended on your own ability to find fulfillment, you will always come up empty. But when you choose the path of faith in God, you'll find a God who is merciful and gracious, loving and kind. He's present and he's active. He's sovereign, transcendent over all, and he's eminent with you in the mess. God cares for you. The call of these two chapters is to trust him with all of our lives, to refuse to take matters into our own hands, to recognize that we have nothing to offer to the equation, and simply receive the blessings that he gives, trusting him with all the details of our lives, good or bad. This is the call. And just like Jacob proved his love for Rachel by completing his work for her, God proves his love to you by completing the work necessary for our salvation, to make us, as the New Testament calls us, his own bride. Jacob worked for Rachel. He finished his work. A better Jacob is Jesus Christ, who takes all who will come to him by faith, who has a selfless love, a perfect love, and did everything necessary for our salvation on the cross. This is the story that begins to be told in the story of our beginnings in Genesis. Have you received that kind of love from God? That's the question. Let's pray together. Lord, thank you for your word.